Welcome to the Ortho Joke Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Well, Mark, welcome. Good afternoon. It's not our usual morning Ortho Joe. So I've had my coffee. I've had my, I had a few cups by now, but hopefully things are well with you.
Yeah, all is well. Two cups and a Diet Coke. So I'm all set. just finished in the OR. I'm raring to go.
Okay. Well, hopefully the weather's nice in Minnesota. It's okay. It's okay in Canada where it's warm. Yeah. We're managing. So
50 degrees and sunny in Minnesota. Always a good thing.
Lovely. I'm also going to make a quick introduction of our guest this afternoon. Brett Petrozor is a professor of orthopedic surgery at McMaster University and practices trauma care with an interest in foot and ankle in McMaster. And hi, Brett. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for
welcome, Brett.
Thank you.
I'm going to jump right into this. There's a ton of interest right now and always has been on hip fractures, but there's also interest in what do we do with the patients, the younger patients with femoral neck fractures. And, you know, there's always been this, well, you know, from the health and the FATES trials, Mark, that, you know, you're well aware of and Brett, you're aware of, you know, the optimal strategies in the elderly, more potentially frail population and those with, you know, sort of the osteoporotic or fragility type fracture. But what about the higher energy fractures in the younger trauma patients? And there was an investigation formed, and I have Brett here because I know he has a little bit of knowledge of this place. It was performed in Edinburgh, Scotland, with the group there at the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh. And they had done a study. It's a retrospective, albeit it's got some of the challenges of being a retrospective study, but it's about 112 consecutive patients under the age of 60. The mean age was 48, ranging anywhere from 20 to 60. So tending still to be, you know, under the age of what we would consider eligible for the health and the faith trials, Mark. Of which over half were male. They were basically retrospectively identified to having undergone fixation of an intracapsular fracture. Here's the gist of it. One in four of these young adult patients undergoing intracapsular hip fracture fixation had a failure. The failure was associated ultimately with a long-term function and health-related quality of life decline. So, you know, if you've gotten through and healed, you're okay to some degree. But if you'd gotten through with a complication, regardless, your quality of life just seemed long. And this was a seven-year follow-up. So this wasn't a short-term follow-up. This really does get to, you know, the importance of some of that longer term. Just one point before I just get your take on this. The loss of fixation represented about 5% of that failure rate. Non-union, another 5% or so of that failure rate. And then avascular necrosis representing the remainder, just over 14%. One in three of these folks required a secondary surgical procedure. So there was, you know, quite a bit of morbidity associated with having this, quote, complication and or failure. And I wonder, when you think of some of those numbers, Mark, from your experience, having done so much work in this area, are these numbers surprising to you? Are you shocked by the fact that we haven't seen potential improvements if they are similar or worse?
No, absolutely not. That's pretty consistent with all of the pooled retrospective literature that we know of. And that's really, unfortunately, the issue is that this is such a rare injury. You know, that age group constitutes 5% or less of the overall intracapsular fracture group, that it will probably never be able to do an RCT. There was an attempt to do that, which I know you're aware of. It's kind of like the young faith that we just couldn't recruit enough to get it sorted out. But these are obviously, because of normal bone density, they're higher energy injuries, which means greater displacement, which means comminution, which means potential injury to the lateral epiphyseal artery complex, resulting in osteonecrosis. Also, the issue of intracapsular tamponade, which I've studied for decades. So I'm not surprised at all.
And when I, you know, think about just in terms, you know, when you think just in terms of outcomes, you know, again, the idea that having a complication leads to worse function. I'll tell you, every time we've done a trial where we show two treatments might have a different reoperation rate, but overall quality of life at 2 or 3 years doesn't seem to be that different, has been a fundamental shift for me as to why we measure quality of life in some of these areas where there's such a fundamental major complication like a reoperation. In this case, though, it seems different. Like in the younger patient, it seems that when you do have a complication, it does have a huge impact on quality of life. I don't know, Brad, you know, from your perspective, I mean, is this what you're seeing? Are you seeing sort of like it doesn't matter too much depending, you know, if you're a little bit older and you have a complication, you can seem to, your quality of life seems to be pretty stable?
Well, it is kind of, and I agree with Mark with respect to the younger thing, the morphology is different and all that sort of stuff. But I think people these days, for instance, I had a patient who is 54 with a different injury, but he's like, you know what? I'm active. I'm an active person. That category of patient from 45 to 55, I think in 2025 is a different category of patient. And they're active and doing things. And if they're not doing the things that they want to do, that's a problem. Whereas if you're maybe a little bit more elderly or even a different generation per se, maybe you're looking at things differently. But I do see it clinically in that age range of patient that, you know, they come in and they're, I'm active. This is what I want to do. This is where I'm going with my life, et cetera. So I can see how something would affect them maybe, whether it's purely physical or psychological, or they're just not doing what they want to do, even though they can do their shopping and do their this sort of thing, they're going to feel that they're not quite getting the quality that they want out of their life. I can see that.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. We had Gerard Slobogian write a commentary to this piece in the journal. And Mark, I suspect you have some thoughts on this. He wrote in this younger population, he said, you know, looking at understanding how many percentage of cases are formed by consultants versus trainees or others who maybe have less training or less experience in the area. And the idea of surgical expertise, particularly in the management of these patients, where you don't really have total joint replacement or hemiarthroplasty as a reasonable early bailout?
Yeah, it's absolutely an issue. The surgical approaches are often not ones that we're used to. Many individuals prefer the Smith-Peterson distal half for the approach. Others, the Watson-Jones. I happen to be a Watson-Jones, but that's not a common procedure. Maybe in these days when trainees are learning anterior approach total hip, it might be a little more comforting, but so it's the approaches, and again, with higher energy fractures of the femoral neck, the comminution is a real issue, and the whole ability to get a reduction and get it accurately and then optimally place implants, it takes some experience. Again, younger people, more heavily muscled, deeper approaches, yes, surgical experience matters.
No, they have said, Mark, that, you know, the prior literature talks about, you know, radiographic malreduction, you know, varus malalignment, malrotation, posterior tilt, you know, even to our thing, you know, shortening that we've talked about sometimes in the past are really generally poor prognostic markers for outcome. Brad, from your perspective, when you're managing these patients, how much, you know, when you think about the technique, are there things you're doing? Are there specific issues that you're really worried about in this patient population when you're, you know, when you're in the throes of the surgical procedure?
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, the morphology of the fracture is often very different. You know, these high energy vertical fracture lines, posterior comminution, and the instability in the femoral head is different as well. And so whether you're using a DH, a sliding hip screw or something like that, you can very easily spin the femoral head. So I'm definitely doing other things to prevent that, doing things to assess that posterior comminution, I think, but it's the spinning of the head a little bit. And then that high vertical fracture line, you know, does it need a screw that's slightly differently placed or a different type of construct that's a bit more angle stable and that sort of thing? It's not just the run of the mill, you know, hip fracture that people learn on. So I think there are some technical things for sure. I'm not doing a lot of intracapsular release of hematoma, but I know Dr. Swiankowski, you know, that's an advocate too. And those are things that people can do as well. But I think there's a technical component to it for sure.
You know, and so much of what we learned, you know, in residency, and I suspect it's still, you know, it's a standard, which is you need to have sliding. Sliding is really important. But then there's a discussion around, well, how much sliding? Too much sliding and it controls. Like, so you get the fracture to heal, but it heals in a varus kind of, you know, in a varus shortened thing where you've got sort of, you've impacted your lever arm, right? And it makes it difficult for patients to move and mobilize. And, you know, we did some of that work some years ago where we looked at this cohort of patients where we looked at, you know, just over 5 millimeters shortening and then up to 10 millimeters shortening. And there was a stepwise decrease in standard functional scores. When you think about fracture fixation now, obviously getting the fracture to heal is critical. How important is the idea of getting it fixed out to length and healing out to length in terms of the relative importance?
It's extremely important regarding the shortening. And that's why we've long been advocates of absolutely anatomic reduction in this setting. And that can be the difficult part to achieve. We addressed that earlier. But if it is an imperfect reduction, in order to limit the risk of non-union, a sliding device is optimum. If the reduction's close, it shouldn't be a centimeter shortening in a younger patient than in an older patient, where the comminution and bone quality really allow greater degree of shortening. So, yeah, and then as Brad alluded to earlier, additional devices, cannulated screws or regular cancella screws first before placing a sliding device. Or if you're going to use multiple cancella screws in this setting, the reduction really should be perfect. Otherwise, you're dependent upon the screws to hold out the length, and they're just not going to do it. And you're going to have greater degrees of varus with multiple screws than a sliding device.
I would agree. Yeah. Some people are advocating, I've not done it, I don't know if you have, Mark, a lot, that medial calcar plate just to prevent that, you know, down. I'm not doing that a lot, but it's certainly in this patient population, you know, with an open reduction, get it anatomic, get a little medial calcar, and then you can slide. You're not going to slide, but you can get your compression without getting your drop. You know what I mean? With vertical fracture lines. Are you using that one a lot?
I have not done that, but I am aware of a paper that Corey Collins presented at the OTA with the aggregate. It was like a systematic review of nearly 600 young femoral neck fractures. And the ones that had that medial plate avoided that loss of reduction in the vertical plane. Yeah. So it seems like it's a good thing to do. A 1/3 tubular plate or a smallish 2.7 or 3.5 short reconstruction plate to prevent that slide. I've used the 90 degree angle lag screw into that spike personally.
Yeah, that's what I use too, just because I think it's easier to do, quite honestly.
Yeah.
And how about the small for the femoral neck fracture, the small side plate? You know, we did, in the studies where we looked at shortening, for whatever reason, this could have been confounding, probably was to some degree, but you know, when you had cancella screws with washers and then they were put together, it's almost like they make a little, kind of like almost like a you know, sort of a side lateral buttress itself there. They seem to have less shortening than others. And we started thinking about, well, maybe there should be femoral neck fracture with, you know, parallel screws that aren't a single sliding hip screw style or a single screw, but you know, with a small side plate. You're starting to see some of those devices come out now. What's your take on that for the management, especially in the younger patients?
Yeah, well, I'll go first. So far, the comparative series, I'm unaware of any RCTs that have been published yet, but in the comparative series comparing multiple screws to these two screw devices with a one hole side plate, it's not shown any difference in outcome to date. So I think surgeon factors and patient factors probably overweight compared to the device that's used.
Yeah. And I would agree. I think there's still other ancillary things to use in the face of the side, that side plate with the multiple screws. I don't think it's going to be the answer, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. I think there are other things that we just talked about that are still going to be important.
Okay. And maybe I'll stop here, but like, So you're designing, you know, you're both very thoughtful individuals. You've done research, lots of it. If you're thinking about the outcome that matters in this particular patient population, patients with young femoral neck fractures, what are the outcomes to you that matter? And again, thinking in the context, let's say if we're going to design the definitive study, assuming we can recruit and we can get compliance and all those sort of things, but what are the outcomes you think we should be measuring?
I'll let you go first on that one, Brad.
Well, you alluded to why are we measuring, you know, patient-reported outcomes. I think that's important. I think we do need to measure those, number one. Number two, you also talk about and teach about outcomes that are important from a surgical point of view. And so reoperation is definitely an outcome, but I don't think you can get away with, or should you get away with, a patient-reported outcome here either. Mm-hmm. I think they're both very important. And the interesting thing is, if reoperation isn't the thing that's affecting people, because people are younger and they can accept another operation sometimes, that's why I think that a combination of that with the reported outcomes is going to be important, I think.
I don't think I'm going to contradict anything Brad said, but for me, it would be gait and range of motion of the hip and functional testing, if you will, walking speed, ability to change directions, et cetera. These younger patients, as you started the conversation with Mo, really, they have higher functional demand. And I think that's why the displeasure with the outcomes being higher in this group is simply because the functional demands are greater. Yeah. And I would put the radiographic outcomes at a distant fourth or fifth, because they do correlate with the things that I mentioned.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you say that, you know, because I reflect on what we do at different clinics and patients that have been injured at work and that sort of thing. Sometimes we'll do a full functional abilities evaluation to see what people can do. And we're not doing that, I don't think, a lot in the research line. You know, people are doing outcomes and things that you can do on a scale, but to get into the physio lab and do a full functional outcomes evaluation, you know, who's necessarily doing that? And maybe that's something that's useful, or at least something to think about, to Mark's point.
Yeah, we did some of that in our early lower extremity fracture outcomes and the limb salvage versus early amputation study, where we did timed stair climb and 100 meter walk and things like that, which are very, they really increase your knowledge of the outcome to a great degree. It's very labor intensive, and you really need to have funding and the ability to train people to do it across site to do it the same way. But very, very valuable outcomes indeed.
Yeah. You know, there was a paper that asked this very, very specific question. Young femoral neck fractures, are we measuring outcomes that matter? And to your point, only one in three of those papers, this is some years ago, actually measured functional outcome. So there was a preponderance of data that was probably more radiographic than it was patient function. And I think the call here was exactly what both of you have suggested, is that we need to really understand the overall patient outcome. And the x-ray may not, in many cases, it may be prognostic, but in many cases, it doesn't really tell you the whole story. And I think that gets back to this idea of, you know, in thinking about these patients, it would be lovely, you know, for us to be able to be talking about clinical trials in this area and prospective clinical trials. But in an environment where we don't have lots of data, these aren't that common fractures, we're going to be having to learn as much as we can from some of the retrospective case series data sets. And again, you know, any evidence we have is valuable if we take it in the context and discuss it, I think, in the way both of you has helped us with this insight. So thank you both for taking a bit of time out of your afternoon and joining us to chat a little bit about this. Hope you have a rest of your day is good, and we'll take this learning with us as we go forward.
Thanks, Mo, and thanks, Brad, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great, and nice to see you both. Thank you.
All right. Take care.